first set of teachers, so it's a shock. But to kind of help us get over shock, here is Steve Fuller, always in New York and originally from Berlin, of course, mainly in New York. Steve Fuller is a well-known sociologist of science. He's professor of sociology at Warwick. He's had a long and varied career. He's something of a controversial figure. He's not afraid of critiquing universally loved philosophers like Thomas Kuhn. And you may have come across a couple of his books. One is Icon Publishers, Popper versus Kuhn, the Struggle for Social Science, which we've mentioned in class. And I've asked Steve to pick up some of the themes we addressed last term. So, for example, the relationship between Kuhn and Popper, where they lie, and in particular, what came along with the science wars and where science studies are now. So I'm going to ask Steve to give his particular version of it. It's being recorded, and in fact it'll be up on Steve's website within 2 days. A nice little funky hard disk sitting there. So Steve is not the kind of person, generally speaking, in front of whom I call the fleet, not because he might punish you, but because he's quite fun. But if there are things you want to return to, you'll be able to go to his website shortly.
That's right, and of course the questions will also be recorded.
Absolutely.
So, you know, if you really want to nail me, here's your opportunity to do so in public. Should I speak for about 40 minutes?
Yeah, why don't you go till about 25?
Okay, all right. Once again, I want to thank Steve for inviting me here. I don't know how many years, it's like maybe five, six years or so, I've every year come to this class. So I get a new generation of people to talk to. And, I mean, the thing that's very striking is how these issues that Steve alluded to earlier and which I've been discussing through my career, they just don't seem to go away. And in a sense, both Steve and I were students together at Cambridge, and the issues were very hot even then, and that was 25 years ago. Okay? And so the question is, what exactly are these issues? And these issues have to do with the nature of science. And in a sense, the arguments haven't changed all that much in a way, but sort of the context in which the arguments are being conducted has changed. And I think that's a very important thing. I mean, because one of the things, very often when we talk about the differences between, let's say, the philosophy and the sociology of science, we don't keep in mind that, in fact, the two of them need to be working together. There's a sense in which the philosophical discussions don't happen in the social vacuum, right? And there's a sense in which the social context in which science is being discussed nowadays has shifted radically over the past 25 years, even though a lot of the arguments and a lot of the terminology remains the same. So, you know about things like relativism and realism and constructivism. All those words were around 25 years ago, okay? This business about whether science is internally or externally driven, that was around 25 years ago. But in a sense, the significance of these debates have changed, okay? And in a sense, when we're going back to people like Kuhn and Popper, as sort of, you know, to legitimate or justify what we're talking about, in a sense, their role shifts as well over time, okay? And in particular, somebody like Thomas Kuhn has played an enormously varied role in all of these kinds of debates. Let me ask the class here, since we've got sort of a new generation of people, how many people here have actually read The Structure of Scientific Revolution, read some part of it? Okay, that's quite a lot. What, did you assign it?
Okay.
Well, no, because, the interesting thing, of course, is that given the various ways in which this book has been used, you'd never guess that so many people have read it. Okay? I mean, this book has sold 1 million copies, it's been translated to over 20 languages, it was first published in 1962, and really took off after its second edition in 1970. This book, as you know, is a rather small, slim book. It was originally a final chapter in the International Encyclopedia of Unified Science, which was the great American project of the logical positivists. And have you heard of the logical positivists? Now, if you've heard anything about them, usually Kuhn is supposed to be the person who buried them, or opposed them, or contested them, yet his volume is the last volume in their series. They approved it for publication. They didn't see a problem with it. Okay, so that already suggests to you that the way in which we understand what's going on here with regard to these various views in the philosophy of science maybe isn't quite right. Okay. Now, from the standpoint of today, I mean, given the sorts of things that you currently maybe learn about science from science studies, sort of people like Bruno Latour, you know, Steve Chapin, David Bloor, Barry Barnes, all these people from science studies. One of the things, if you have that already have that kind of mentality about science, one of the things that looks very striking when you look at somebody like Kuhn or the logical positivist or Karl Popper, is that these people from the past, talk about science as if it were one thing. Right? They have a kind of unified view of science. All right? And so in a sense, and in fact, certainly this is, you know, even someone who you might say isn't so obviously in that category, like Kuhn himself, certainly the way he's been used suggests that he's giving some kind of all-purpose blueprint for how to turn your discipline into a science. And in fact, the fields in which Kuhn has been most influential have been the fields that he never talks about. In fact, the field that he's least influential in is the one he actually knew something about and got a PhD in, which is physics. And if you actually read that book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, it's really only about physics with a little bit of chemistry. Yet if you think of all the various fields that have picked up on this book and have used it as a way of modeling their own historical progress, their own way of justifying their knowledge claims, you would think that Kuhn was talking about biology and the social sciences and the humanities and nursing and librarianship and business schools and all God knows what. But he doesn't talk about any of that stuff. And in fact, he's very deliberate about this. In fact, if you get so far as the introduction to the book, he talks about, now of course people maybe don't make it that far, the cover's so attractive, but the thing is, if you actually get to the introduction, you actually see him saying this, right? Because he basically gives you what he considers to be his great sort of eureka moment when he discovered the secret to science, which has to do with this business of paradigms and normal science, which you probably know about. And it came about when he was a visiting fellow at Stanford's Institute for Advanced Studies in the Behavioral Sciences. That is to say, a place where a lot of social scientists hang out. And he saw the way in which these guys argue about things when somebody would come in to deliver a seminar paper. And what was really striking was that the sort of authorities that these people would bring up, the social scientists, as kind of models for what good practice was in their particular discipline. So they might, let's say, back in those days, in the late 50s, they might have quoted B.F. Skinner, the behavioral psychologist, or Freud, or maybe John Maynard Keynes in economics, right, or Weber or Durkheim in sociology, right? And the thing that was very striking about all of these figures was that the ones who were, as it were, most influential in grounding particular disciplines were also the most controversial. In other words, they were the most divisive. They were the ones around whom it was very difficult to get agreement on. So from that standpoint, from the way Kuhn looks at things, that those fields don't have paradigms, because in fact the most influential people are the most divisive people. Okay? They're not rallying points the way, for example, Newton was for physics for 200 years, basically from the beginning of the 18th century to the beginning of the 20th century. And, you know, some people might want to claim Darwin's this way, but if you actually look at the history of biology closely, it's pretty hard to figure out when exactly there's been closure around Darwin, even within biology. Maybe the neo-Darwinian synthesis, but that only takes us back about 1940. Okay? So the point is, if we have this kind of Kuhnian view that science is something that's closed under a paradigm, that is to say, you have one big theory, which has kind of metaphysical import in a way, right, under which everybody agrees and does their research, and under which all the major problems in the field are defined, and you can actually identify what are the open problems. So like for many generations, when Newtonian mechanics was the paradigm of physics, people knew exactly what had been solved and what had not been solved. So there are issues about the nature of light, for example, where Newton himself is very ambiguous, and lots of experiments had to be conducted, and all the rest of it. Okay, for a long time, once electricity was discovered in the 18th century, that was a problem too, right? Magnetism, that was a problem. Right? They're well-defined problems, and they're problems with respect to this covering theory. And moreover, not only is there this covering theory with specific problems, but there's also prescribed methods that you use to solve the problems, so that somebody else in the field can recognize whether or not you solved the problem. Now, you might think this is all pretty obvious stuff. This is scientific method 101. But the amazing thing is how difficult it's been to get agreement on these matters in the history of science. Okay? And indeed, one of the things that's very striking about Kuhn's picture of science is that if you actually try to sort of think of it historically, because, you know, it, as you know, his book is sort of presented as kind of, you might say, a cycle. It's a kind of cyclical account of science, where, you know, you move to building up the paradigm, then you've got it in place, then you do normal science, then you hit anomalies, then you have a crisis, and then you move on to the next paradigm. So it kind of goes around in a circle, in a way. Well, the thing that's very striking about this is the fact that it's kind of hard to actually map very long periods of the history of science on this, especially if you start looking at the details of Kuhn's account. Because Kuhn is actually making reference to different things about the institutionalization of science that in fact happen at different points in history and don't fit into this neat cyclical pattern that he's talking about. Now, what all this means, in a way, is to say that Kuhn's picture of science is like every other philosopher's picture of science. Okay? In the sense that it picks and chooses from the history, right, to sort of suit a kind of normative view about what science ought to be. And this is why people like Popper and the positivists saw Kuhn as a kindred spirit, as somebody worth arguing with. Okay, that's a very important point, I think, because the spirit in which science studies is conducted these days is really very different from what those philosophers, including Kuhn, were on about. So as you know, right, from science studies today, the first thing you learn in science studies is science is plural, right? Multiple sciences. Everyone is sort of organized a different way. Even things that we call disciplines aren't unified. They're in fact full of what's called heterogeneous practices, right? There's all of this kind of annoying terminology that gets used, you know, which means that there's lots of different kinds. And every discipline's like that. And so from that standpoint, a discipline like biology or chemistry or sociology or even physics is kind of just a word, as it were, maybe something worth fighting over from the standpoint of gaining resources, let's say, to get a grant or to staff your department or something like that, but it doesn't refer to anything that's conceptually unified. This is science study's starting point today. This is radically different from what all these philosophers, including Kuhn, were talking about. So when Kuhn writes The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, no differently from the logical positivist or Popper, he is trying to come up with, as it were, the essence of science. And this is why he feels that he can be kind of discretionary in the way in which he picks out stuff from the history and so forth. Now, the difference between Kuhn and, let's say, especially Popper and his people, and by Popper's people, I mean Imre Lakatos and Paul Feyerabend and all these people who were associated with Popper at the London School of Economics in the 1960s and 70s. Now, the difference between these guys with regard to this issue is that the Popperians, in a sense, the way they talked about the nature and essence of science, you might say, was in a purely negative way. So in other words, the way you sort of understood what these guys were going after was by looking at what they were trashing. And somebody like Lakatos, for example, believed that most of the history of science has been one long diversion. Right? So he said that the way you ought to be doing the history of science, if you want to be philosophically, you know, respectable, is that you ought to, you know, as it were, tell how the story should have proceeded had people been following the right methods, and then put the actual history in the footnotes. Okay, so you, as it were, a philosopher says, who's boss here, right? You know, so in other words, we talk about the normative ideal of science, and then we see how, in fact, the history has diverged from that. Now, no less than Kuhn, the Popperians had historical bases for their ideas of science. They didn't just cook them up out of thin air. They thought, too, that Newton, Galileo, Einstein in particular, were, in fact, exemplary cases of science. No doubt about it. But what they found exemplary about those cases was something different than Kuhn did. And moreover, they believed that the best way, in fact, to talk about the nature of science was by talking about how it failed to meet these ideal conditions. So philosophy of science then becomes a primarily critical activity. Okay? That was kind of the point for all those guys. Kuhn operates totally differently. Okay? And in fact, the way Kuhn, when there was a big debate at the LSE in 1965, and this is where the title of this recent book of mine comes from, the Kuhn versus Popper, right? That actually took place as an event in July of 1965. And in the course of that debate, many of the papers of which you can find in a book called Criticism and the Growth of Knowledge by Imre Lakatos was the editor, what you find when Kuhn has to defend himself, basically, what he says is, look, my account of science is an account of how science is when it is functioning as it should. So in other words, he's casting the issue in a positive light. He's not actually telling you what he doesn't think is science. He's not telling you what he doesn't like about science. In fact, that's the interesting thing about Kuhn. It's a very telling thing about Kuhn, is he never criticizes. He never argues against. He just presents, as it were, what the positive picture is. Now, his readers look at that positive picture and immediately conclude that he's talking about all of science and that he, in fact, approves of the way in which all of science has been, in fact, developing. Nothing could be farther from the case. The telling thing is that Kuhn's model of science, as I've mentioned earlier, takes up only the history of physics, and even then, only about 300 years of the history of physics. Okay? Now, there's also some stuff on the history of chemistry. I don't want to deny that. But it's interesting that the history of chemistry ends in the beginning of the 19th century for Kuhn. Now, what's going on here? Now, you can't say, oh, well, you know, Kuhn's a historian or a philosopher or something like that. He doesn't know any science, so as it were, he can only talk about the stuff from the past when things were a lot simpler. No, that's not true, because Kuhn is a PhD in physics. It's the only subject he has any credentials in. And as I pointed out to you, the physicists are the ones who have the biggest problems with him. You know. But the point is, that's the only thing that Kuhn is educated in. All of his degrees were in physics. Okay? So Kuhn knew, he was trained as a physicist. He was in fact in World War II jamming radar signals in East Anglia. Okay? His PhD director got the Nobel Prize in 1977 for having figured out some stuff about electromagnetism. Okay? So he actually knew real physics. He knew contemporary, up-to-date physics, but he never talked about it. Why not? Why did he stop talking about physics in the 1920s? So with basically Heisenberg and Bohr, with the uncertainty principle, that's kind of where he ends it. He never talked about any physics after that point in any of his writings. And in fact, when he does his own kind of historical, detailed historical work later on, he just talks about Max Planck. So that's even the generation before Bohr and Heisenberg. So what's going on here? Well, I think one of the things that is very clear, if you look at the overall kind of sense of Kuhn, like why did Kuhn leave physics, for example? Okay, after World War II, with the Cold War starting up, there are plenty of jobs in physics. Big boom area, but Kuhn didn't go into it. And he's a Harvard PhD. It wasn't that he didn't have good credentials. Okay? I mean, the thing that I think is really important here, and this is where Kuhn becomes kind of a very important cultural figure, and this is where the context in which all this stuff is being done becomes very important, is that, remember, Kuhn's account of science as being driven by paradigms and normal science and puzzle solving presupposes that the people who determine what science is and where it should go and all the rest of it are the scientists. Okay? It's the scientists. They are the only people who figure in Kuhn's account. No commissars, no funding agencies, okay? And also no philosophers. So there's no Popper or Lakatos saying what to do either. All there are scientists determining how to do science. Now, one of the interesting things, of course, is that you look at those 300 years of the history of physics from the beginning of the 17th century to the beginning of the 20th century, you find out a few things, which in a way distinguishes it from the way in which chemistry went over that period, and that is, it is still a pretty low-tech discipline. That is to say, you don't need a lot of heavy apparatus. You don't need to spend a lot of money. You need time to do the experiments. You need time to do the calculations. Newton was certainly helped out by the plague, for example. They got him out of his teaching duties for a while. I mean, those aren't trivial points in the history of science, okay? You need the time and the space. But you didn't need the material resources to do the experiments. All the equations were done on the blackboard. You didn't need big computers, okay? So basically, we're talking little science. Physics as little science. And, you know, chemistry is the first science to be big science. And that happens in the 19th century when it got very involved with industrial processes. Physics becomes a big science really only in the 1930s and 40s, and of course really takes off, you know, with the atomic bomb and all that. Okay? And so Kuhn's account is an account of little science because, see, it's only when science isn't very expensive that actually you can kind of follow the logic of the argument to their conclusion, that you can actually test all the claims, give them the fair treatment they deserve, and so forth, because there's a sense in which you can afford to be wrong. Right? I mean, it does, you know, I mean, imagine, it might take a long time for you to set up an experiment, it might take you a long time to do the calculations, but you're not spending somebody else's money here. There aren't any expectations that the results of what you do is going to save the world or blow up the world, whichever's preferable, depending on who's funding you, right? I mean, it's just your own little problems that you and your colleagues in the paradigm have set for yourselves. So it's very, you know, it's not resource intensive, this kind of activity. And that's why, if you look at the role that technology plays in Kuhn's account, it's only the technology that's involved in setting up the experiments. Now, you know, in science studies, we make a lot of deal today about, practices, scientific practices. It's not all just about theories and discourse, but it's like really, you know, people got to do stuff in the labs. It's messy and stinky and all the rest of it. Yes, but, and Kuhn sees that, right? But the key thing about Kuhn is it's not expensive. It takes skill. Not any bozo can do it. Theoreticians can't do it necessarily. You do need technicians. But you don't need really expensive stuff, and there's no expectation that the stuff that you're using to do your experiments is going to end up doing something outside of the scientific context. So there are no technological expectations about science. Okay? See, in this respect, Kuhn is still very much part of the mindset of the Popperians and the positivists, whereby there is a split in their mind, a kind of intellectual split in their mind between science and technology. Right, where in a sense, in order for it to work properly, in order to actually get results from science that can be used for the benefit of humanity and all that, you've got to get the science straight first. And so again, if you look at Kuhn's account of science, right, the only kind of sociology that's relevant is the sociology involved in bringing people into a paradigm. How do you get educated? How do you get acculturated into a paradigm? Right. But then after that, it's all pretty much determined internally. Kuhn doesn't tell you something, he doesn't tell you anything about the military-industrial complex. He doesn't tell you anything about the issues that Marxists have been traditionally concerned about concerning the economic basis and implications of science. He doesn't go into any of that stuff. And it's not because people hadn't done it before. In fact, there'd already been a long discussion about these matters way before Kuhn. Okay? But Kuhn doesn't touch any of this stuff. Okay, I think that's very important because there is a question here, in a way, about what exactly does Kuhn have to say to science studies when he gets right down to it. The interesting thing, of course, is that people in science studies always pick up on Kuhn as somehow a kind of mythical father figure of the field. And those of you, though, who know anything about what Kuhn thought of science studies, he couldn't stand the field. Right? Kuhn thought, Kuhn's view about science studies, he gave a very famous lecture at Harvard in 1992, which is reprinted in The Rhodes Instructor, which is a collection of his philosophical essays from the 80s and the 90s. It came out in 2000. And there's a lecture in there, the Rothschild Lecture, 1992, where if you didn't know better, you would have thought Kuhn was Alan Sokol, right, of the, Sokol and Brinkmann fame, who wrote the book, what's it called? It's called Intellectual Impostures in this country, right? In America, it's called Fashionable Nonsense because Americans didn't know what the word imposture meant, apparently. But the point is, right, this book, if you've seen this book, what this book is, basically, is a lot of French thinkers, including Latour, basically sort of taken apart for their faulty understanding of philosophy and science and everything else, and Kuhn was of that mind. And you see this in the Rothschild Lecture in 1992, 4 years before he died. So Kuhn had never been a friend of science studies, okay? He did not identify with the field at all. And in fact, so this then raises the issue, okay, exactly what's going on here, all right? Well, the thing I think that science studies picked up from Kuhn very early on, and this is where Kuhn was very different from the Popperian and the positivist, is that, remember I said earlier, Kuhn's account of science is really internally driven. in the sense that it's scientists determining science. And when I say scientists are determining science, that means no philosophers allowed. Because there is this use of the word internalism in philosophy of science that's meant to include philosophers as if they were scientists. But that's not Kuhn's view. Philosophers stay out. Okay. So now what this means, let me just spell this out to you, because this becomes very important in understanding where the strong program, if you know the Edinburgh School, Bloor, Barnes, those people, those guys, and here they're very much on the same page as Kuhn, those guys, science is what scientists say it is. End of story. Now, if scientists bring in political considerations, if they bring in economic or religious considerations, then that's part of science. But the scientists are the ones who are calling the shots about what science is. There is no distinction, either in Kuhn or in Barnes and Bloor, between science and what scientists do. Okay? That kind of conflation is really the Kuhnian legacy to science studies. It's just that. Because again, remember what I said about Popper, and the same applies to the logical positivist, right? In a sense, those guys they have a very clear sense of the difference between science with a capital S and what scientists do. And sometimes the scientists are living up to capital S science, but sometimes they're not. And of course, you know, if you think about the context of World War II, for example, right, and the whole 20th century, right, you can imagine the sorts of contexts in which the positivists and the Popperians would say that scientists do not live up to capital S science. You can think of Nazi science, you can think of the sort of Soviet Lysenko business with eugenics, all this kind of stuff. There are all these cases where you could make an argument that politics in some way contaminated, corrupted, perverted, whatever science. So there, and even though most of the scientists in the country, you know, we're wearing armbands and saluting and all the rest of it, that doesn't make it science. That's what the philosophers were saying, people like Popperians and the positivists. And from that standpoint, these guys saw themselves as championing certain kind of liberal free inquiry values, right? Because in a sense, you have to separate out science from the scientists, because sometimes the scientists get captured by the political authorities. And so you have to have some kind of independent court of appeal to say, look, they're not living up to what they should be doing. They're being corrupt. They're contaminated. Okay? So that's the kind of point that the positivists and the Popperians want to make about keeping a distinction between science and scientists. But this is not something that Kuhn did not play this game at all. Okay? And neither did people in science studies. Now this is kind of interesting because, you know, like as I said in the very beginning, we move forward now from the time these debates first got started, so we go forward like a quarter century, 30 years, and we live in a different world with regard to science and society than we did back then. And in particular, the Cold War is over. Okay? And you see, back in the old days, you know, when Steve and I were still in short pants, The thing that was very striking, one of the reasons why it was very persuasive to talk about science in the singular was because it was kind of easy to imagine how science developed and was transmitted, because you sort of thought in terms of scientific discipline. And even if the positivists and the Popperians weren't right that there was some like one unified scientific method, nevertheless, there was a sense in which you could say, well, at least each discipline has a kind of natural integrity of its own. Okay? And how did you know this? Well, because there's certain places where you study to become a member of the discipline, there's a certain continuous body of knowledge, it's transmitted, and in a sense the people who teach it have control over what they're doing. And moreover, even when it came to funding, even though we had already moved into a period of big science, the funding was centralized too. So in other words, the state, right, what I'm referring to here is the role of something like the National Science Foundation in the United States played as a kind of model for how you fund science in the second half of the 20th century. This very much contributed to the kind of mentality that fostered the philosophy of science, because this was the first time, see, people don't realize this, This was the first time where funding was centralized in a peer review process. Funding, okay? Because as you know, peer review process, the idea of scientists judging other scientists and judging who's eligible to be a scientist, the idea of peer review, of course, goes back at least to the beginning of the scientific academies in the 17th century, maybe even before. But there, the issue wasn't really funding, but it was more approval for publication. In other words, are we going to put our stamp of approval on this work you've already done? You get your money by your independent means, and then we decide, the great and the good, whether this really fits what we call science. And then if it is, it gets put in our proceedings, right? That's what the Royal Society is about. Okay? So you've got all these independently wealthy guys who have all their different ways of getting money, and they basically present their results, and if the peers like the results, they get published and it gets the seal of approval. And that's how journals work. Right? Journals, academic journals, they work that way. But what you start to get after World War II, which becomes very important in terms of channeling the activity of scientific disciplines in a way that really hadn't been channeled before. I mean, the only, you know, Germany provided the precedent for this, actually, at the end of the 19th century. You already see this in Germany. But it's when the United States does it at the end of World War II, picking up on all the good ideas from the Germans, right? You always learn from the losers, right, kind of thing, and the U.S. certainly did that. You know, they picked up on this in a big way, and the rest of the world copied it. And the idea was that you have peer review funding process that's centralized in a state agency, and so then you can really chart in a very clear way how the discipline's developing. Because everybody basically, if they want to really get a lot of money to do the kind of big research, and remember, after World War II, money matters in terms of the significance of research in a way it didn't do before, so you're going to be forced to go to something like the state, okay, that they can chart how things are developing, they can channel, right, things get much more focused, more centralized. Now, why is this? Well, because people believed, and here Kuhn's mentor is a very important figure, James Bryan Conant, president of Harvard University and the U.S. administrator of the atomic bomb project. Okay? He's also the first American ambassador to West Germany after World War II. This guy was a very important guy. Okay? He's the guy to whom Structure Scientific Revolutions is dedicated. He was the guy who gave Kuhn his first job and allowed him to transition out of physics into this kind of history and philosophy of science stuff he ended up doing. Well, this guy, Conant, was one of the ones. There was another guy, Vannevar Bush, who was the vice president of MIT, was a friend of Conant's. Both of these guys really pushed the idea that the best way to promote science, right, was for the government to get behind basic research and not allow what had happened in the past in the United States. Because if you look at the way science was being funded in the U.S. before World War II, and the U.S. was a big scientific player before World War II, it was primarily industrial. Big chemical companies, you know, so DuPont and General Electric, you know, and the beginning of IBM and some of the, and of course the Bell Labs being the real big one from the Bell Telephone Company. All of these were the big players. And what Conant and Bush basically pushed was the idea that the state ought to be kind of the majority shareholder in science, because science was essential to national security. National security in an era where we're going to be in a state of permanent emergency. And this is where the Cold War comes in, right? We never know. We might be really close to a war, and we've got to be prepared. Okay? So that's a very important part of the equation, and that persuades the United States government after World War II, and then other places start to copy it en masse. So you start to get real centralization going on here. Okay, so it's in that context that you could see, you know, Kuhn and Popper and the positivists and this idea of one science, a unified conception of science, or at least science kind of all moving together, science all thinking the same way. You know, scientists, as it were, being willing to be judged by their peers, as it were, being all sort of, willing to accept that they may be wrong if others who are more knowledgeable judge them to be so. All of that made sense in this new institutional context. But with the end of the Cold War, what we get almost immediately, you know, as soon as the Soviet Union falls, right, we get the devolution of science funding. That is to say, the state, you know, the first, you know, as you know, those of you who study any kind of political or economic history know one of the things you start to see in the 1980s, maybe you might remember Margaret Thatcher, right, is you get this fiscal crisis of the welfare state, right? The tax burden becomes too large, it becomes harder to justify, governments can't support themselves anymore, and so they cut taxes. Well, when you cut taxes, you got to cut spending. And so where does the spending get cut? Well, it tends to get cut in areas where you imagine the private sector can pick up the slack. And science is one of them. Okay? And what you see during this period is you see a sea change. And scientists, like cockroaches, adapt. Right? But not all scientists can adapt so well. And so what you start to see closures of the departments that were very heavily reliant on state-based funding. So certain branches of physics are going under. Chemistry, they have to now rebrand themselves as nanotechnologists, right? I mean, all of these things, I mean, you get a big sea change. And what flourishes? The biomedical sciences. Well, why does biomedical sciences flourish? I mean, the interesting thing from the standpoint of the philosophy of science is that these sciences were never considered terribly interesting before the end of the Cold War. Okay? It was always physics. Everything was physics, right? It wasn't biology or anything like that. Karl Popper didn't even think, natural selection was a proper scientific theory. Okay? But all of a sudden, in the Cold War, everything's in the biomedical sciences now. Well, the biomedical sciences has a somewhat different character from physics in its heyday, okay? So, for example, when we talk about the biomedical sciences as kind of, as it were, the new paradigm of science, we're not worried about the fact that it's not unified. There's no master covering theory that takes in everything that falls under that rubric. People aren't so worried about some sharp distinction between science and technology. In fact, the fields are kind of technology-driven in a way. Okay? And moreover, and this is the kicker, right, the funding is not centralized at all. See, one of the reasons why the biomedical sciences are not unified and why they're getting more and more diversified and fragmented is because there are different constituencies with different amounts of money and different interests funding the different branches of biology. Okay? So, back in the old days, you might say, sort of in the beginning, when people started to try to think about biology as if it were a kind of physics of life, right? People would say, neo-Darwinian synthesis, maybe that's kind of like, Newtonian mechanics or something, kind of a covering theory, right? And then we can imagine maybe molecular biology perhaps is kind of giving us something like the atomic structure of life or something like that, with genetics and all that. And then maybe we can have a kind of more holistic thing, ecology, that's somehow integrated with that. People don't even bother with that anymore. Okay? There is a really telling book, in a way, kind of a benchmark book in the philosophy of science, which written by a guy, and this is very characteristic of our times, I think, a guy who's very friendly with science studies. In fact, he's in this very country right now as we speak. John Dupre. I want to mention him. He's at Exeter University, okay? And this gives you a sense of kind of where we are in the world today. Okay. Now, John Dupre is a philosopher of science. In fact, he was trained at Cambridge, just like we were, right? Okay. He is now in the sociology department, like I am, actually. And he is head of a genetics and society unit. Okay? He wrote a book about 10 years ago called The Disorder of Things. The Disorder of Things. Okay? And this is kind of a play. If those of you, I don't know if you know about Foucault, right? Foucault wrote a book called The Order of Things in 1970, which was a very important book in post-structuralist, post-humanist thinking. But in any case, Dupre, what he argues in this book is basically, it's a kind of a claim, and a claim I think now that's very widely held by philosophers of science of the ascendant generation, so people of my age group and a little older, namely that the whole quest for unity was a mistake, and that even at the metaphysical level, we should not be expecting a unified conception of reality. Rather, in order to do science, we really need no more metaphysical coherence than we currently have in biology. And biology is a mess. But it's a happy mess, right? This is the idea, right? It's a happy mess. So there are so the different branches of biology presuppose different kinds of metaphysical views. They presuppose different kinds of theories, they have different kinds of aims, and they all kind of happily go about their business independently of each other. And nobody's out there worrying about, oh my God, it's not all unified. Okay? Now, you might say, well, what about Darwin? Right? Doesn't he unify everything? Well, God bless you if you think that's true. I mean, Darwin is made for export biology. I mean, basically, it's for the punters, right? You talk a lot about Darwin when you want to write a popular book to give the impression that we've got some over... It's kind of like the Stephen Hawking effect, right? I mean, you know, Stephen Hawking's views are completely speculative with regard to real physics, but it's great to sell physics to the masses. Well, Darwinism's a bit like that. Because if you look at biology, you look at the full range of articles currently being published in journals in biology, you will find no more than 5 to 8% of them even have anything to do with Darwin or Darwinism. In other words, if the creationists got their way tomorrow and were able to tank Darwin completely, you wouldn't lose much of actual everyday biology. You wouldn't lose much. You certainly wouldn't lose the medical side of it. Okay, some aspects of natural history would be problematic, obviously, because of the time frames and things like this. But that's a relatively small percentage of all the biology going on in the world today. Most of it is being funded by pharmaceutical companies, and they don't have any great metaphysical views about how many billions of years people have been on the planet. Okay? So that's a very important point here, right? That there's a sense in which, you know, now if you think about how this would look to a positivist or a Popperian or even a Thomas Kuhn, they'd be scandalized, right? Because it would just show the extent to which science was no longer a closed, unified system, let alone something going in some kind of coherent direction. Because remember, the reason why we got so interested in science in the first place in philosophy was because we thought science was kind of the motor of social progress. Right? That is to say, as science leads, society follows. Right? And this was the whole idea behind positivism when it was first coined by Auguste Comte in the 19th century. This was the great dream, right? But what happens if your image of science has so radically changed that now all you have is this kind of diversity, this fragmentation, a kind of napalm of sciences, intellectual shrapnel all over the place, not going anywhere in particular, but benefiting and hurting things kind of randomly? Because that is kind of what it looks like today, okay? And it is a function of the fact that you have these many different constituencies for science, all of which, as it were, can pay for the science they want. The state is no longer the majority shareholder, has very little control over what's going on. Universities don't even have control over their curricula in terms of what gets taught under these disciplines, because they're worried about getting enough students, and to worry about getting students is to worry about the jobs they're going to. And so then you go back to who the constituencies are for these disciplines. So the overall picture looks, you know, really quite different from the way things were in the Cold War, when it was plausible, at least, to have this idea that there's some kind of unified, focused, directed picture of science. At the moment, there's nothing of the sort. And see, this is why things like constructivism and relativism and all this stuff is so popular now, because it actually fits the facts in a way it didn't do before. So in other words, you know, if you go to the United States now, I'll give you a good example. People have a very kind of a false image of what real creationists are like. Because everybody thinks a creationist is a person who believes that, you know, the world was created in 6 days, end of story, you can read it in the Bible. That's a really small minority of those guys, okay? Most of the creationists out there are guys who are funding big medical faculties. And they're doing real science in those medical faculties, and they don't need Darwin to do it. And they're not doing anything weird. It's a fact, you don't need Darwin to do it. Darwin is just ideological superstructure with regard to most of biological research, except for certain aspects of natural history. Okay, and so that's an interesting, you know, so, you know, when you think about it, that's a different way in which the major theory in the field relates to the sub-disciplines than, let's say, Newtonian mechanics, which actually did give some guidance as to how to do research, did give you some sense of what was a solvable problem and so forth. That's not really the case with Darwin. You can do all kinds of perfectly good medical research and go to church on Sunday and believe in God and believe the Bible's true. Now see, that's a relativist dream to realize, to see this in action. That's a relativist dream. That's exactly what the relativist wants you to believe is true about science. And the problem is, it is true. That is true. That is happening. You know, it's not that if you have a kind of a view that God created the universe, you're going to do bad science. No, that doesn't follow at all. It never followed historically, and it doesn't follow now. And this is the thing, right? that the reason why all of these science studies views are so popular now, I remember, look, science studies is popular not because people in this field in science studies, first of all, it's not because there's so many of them, and second of all, it's not because these people are like winning massive arguments with philosophers. None of that's happening. Rather, the kinds of views they're promoting actually do get funded. So science studies is a very, if you have the kinds of relativistic, constructivist views of science that science studies have, you can actually make sense of actual science as it's going on now, probably a lot better than if you have the traditional philosophical views. So from the standpoint of a funding agency that's looking to see what does science look like on the ground, we're trying to figure out who we should be funding, what should we do about science, how do we get the best information about what's happening on the ground, it is probably better to hire someone who has a very open-minded view about the way science is developing. Because science is not as one would think it is if you have those older views. And that's kind of the way it is now, you see, because you might think at a philosophical level, you know, relativism, constructivism, these things don't hold on any water, and that you can make three-line refutations of these things. And maybe you can. And maybe you can. But the key point here is it doesn't matter. They're still getting funded because it, what they're actually doing and the kinds of stories they're telling actually fit the world we live in, okay? And so, you know, if you're concerned, you know, if you have some kind of inkling about some larger normative conception of science as a kind of motor of social progress, as a vehicle of rationality, if you still have a hankering for those big philosophical ideals, well, you're going to have to take some political action, frankly, because the world isn't heading in your direction. Seriously. I mean, and the first place you might want to start is by defending the integrity of the university, okay? Because at the moment, as you know, the university is one of the institutions that is most driven by market considerations in terms of how they field courses, how they design curricula, and so forth. Universities operate in a purely reactive and responsive fashion to all these kinds of changes that I've been telling you about, okay? And the point is, if you believe that science is in fact going to, you know, that it should be a progressive force, a rational force, a force that in a way can stand above and apart from market conditions, then it seems to me you're going to have to reform the university, because traditionally that has been the place where it's been possible to take things in these more enlightened directions. But it's losing its momentum very quickly. Okay, well look, I think I'll stop right here and start to take your questions. And thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you, Steve. Okay, the question, please.
This gentleman, he was...
Okay, yeah, you know, on the Darwinism and biology question, how can modern molecular biology, with all this big data, I mean, I work for Jeff, how can, with all the big databases, how can it actually make any sense except in the light of Darwinism?
Do you need it? No, the point, it's not that it says Darwinism is false, do you need it at all?
Yes, you do.
How?
Yes, absolutely you do. Because, I mean, all of these databases are based on looking at family trees and genes, looking at the relationship, the evolutionary relationship. When you line up genes and say, this gene is related to this in this organism, related to this gene in this organism, yeah, the whole basis of all the genetic databases around is Darwinism.
Well, wait a minute now. Let's not go too fast here.
The whole
there's issues of taxonomy. Okay, so you're talking about a taxonomic thing here, and the science of taxonomy and biology can in fact be abstracted away from all of Darwinism is a big package. It's not just about taxonomy. It's about issues of, you know, the age of the Earth and about causal mechanisms and things like that.
So not everybody works on Darwinism, but the basic assumptions of it, of selection on the molecular level, of evolutionary relationships between genes, yeah, that's embedded in everything that we do.
I bet for the field of biology you work in, this, and I would say this is true for every branch of biology any of you work in, look, Darwinism isn't just, as it were, one theory. It's kind of a way of relating lots of different methods and theories within biology under some kind of general picture of how the universe developed, basically. What you've identified in your remarks are certain methods, certain aspects that can be abstracted out and are obviously necessary for the kind of work you do, but do not add up to Darwinism. Darwinism is more than what you are talking about.
Of course it is, but without the assumptions of Darwinism, you wouldn't have the these things?
I'm not sure that's true. You need the methods you're talking about, but I don't know if you need the assumptions. You need the methods, but I don't know if you need the assumptions, the things that make Darwinism distinctive. Because look, there is a school of taxonomy, you know, the cladists. I don't know if you, some of you in biology might know this, you know, in the kind of natural history side, right? These guys are the great arch taxonomers. They're most of them are skeptics about Darwin, as in terms of the causal story about how you get the taxonomy that you get, okay? And for every method and every theory that Darwinism relies on to support its case, you will find within specialists of those fields people who are skeptical of the whole big Darwin story. They don't need the whole big Darwin story to do the kind of work they need to do in their particular area. And that's the tricky part, you see. They need, you know, so Darwinism isn't just, as it were, one theory. It's kind of the relationship between lots of methods and theories under a covering rubric.
But, I mean, the very basic idea, the evolutionary relationship is a natural selection of, you know, I mean, so really what I'm talking about is neo-Darwinism.
Sure.
Classical Darwinism. But, you know, without that, anyway, I'm just going on a circle, so I suppose, but without that, I just don't see how any of this, structures of these databases make sense. Why line things up and say this says this is so many years, million years diverged from this? Why?
Well, all I can tell you is that, as a matter of fact, relatively little of actual biological research makes any reference to Darwinism at all.
What I'm saying is it's implicit.
That's easy to say. Okay, easy. You know, we live in a scientific culture where citation is king. Right, and to say something's implicit, I think, in a way, it's fudging a lot of very difficult issues.
It's so fundamentalist.
You say that. I mean, but I'm just not sure. I mean, it would be interesting as a thought experiment to see what would happen if, in fact, you got rid of Darwinism tomorrow. Because I doubt that much of everyday biology would change. I really doubt it. I mean, there's a sense in which there's a big ideological battle. I mean, the battle for Darwinism is clearly an ideological battle, and there's something very important at stake with regard to rationality and how you derive authority in a secular society and all that kind of stuff. And those are not trivial matters. I don't want to understate the triviality of it. But does it matter for doing science? That's a totally different issue. It's not the Darwinism battle is really a political battle, it seems to me. An important one, but it doesn't seem to me a scientific battle.
Next question.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
I was wondering, you were talking about Kuhn, and said that what he was talking about was correct for science in a period that's gone in the past. And now they're talking about the stuff that's come after that is kind of better for saying what's going on now. So do you think the philosophy of science, rather than being like a kind of philosophy, more a kind of contemporary history of science?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, there's a lot of truth to that, I think. I think the Popperians were very sensitive to this point. The ease with which philosophy of science, and same with sociology of science, can just become ideology of science, right? Namely, just a reflection of what's going on at the moment. And that's why the Popperians were always keen about being critical, right? About emphasizing how much actual science deviates from what the ideals are. Because in that sense, then, you can ensure, at the very least, that philosophy has a kind of autonomy and independence from what's actually going on in science. Because if your philosophical theories always fit the science that's dominant now, so John Dupré being an example, there is always the suspicion that it is, at the end of the day, just ideology. Of course, in the time you're living, nothing ever seems like ideology, right? At the time you're living, right, the philosophy of science that is current always seems profound and deep and significant and really captures everything that needs to be captured. But then when you move a generation or two and you look back, you begin to realize, wow, these guys were really just, you know, why were they so keen about diversity? Why were they so keen about heterogeneity? You know, why? Well, because basically science had gotten exploded by market conditions and we're moving in a million different directions at once. Right? I mean, and that's what I think 50 years from now people are going to be saying about this time. That basically, this is an example of what science looks like in a neoliberal culture, right? I mean, I think that's basically what people like Dupré are giving you. Even though, if you're actually studying philosophy of science now in a proper philosophy department, right, that'll be the funky stuff. That'll be the progressive stuff. But I think 50 years from now, it'll be pretty obvious that this is just the face of neoliberalism in the philosophy of science. That's my prediction. It's on...
more questions.
By the way, you know, I didn't mention Latour very much, but in a sense, he's even more like this, right? In a sense, he intensifies this tendency, because Latour doesn't even have any kind of pretension of science being separated out from anything else, right? It's all just about getting action in the world. And so, for him, science is an amalgam of technology, science, other sorts of things, and there is really no clear distinction between these matters. Right? So in a sense, there's no particular direction that science takes you in, other than the direction that the particular people, who have the power to fund it, are able to take it in. And that is very much kind of the times we live in, right? That is very much the kind of times we live in.
Steve, what do you think? Sorry, you asked a question.
I was just thinking, so when I talk to my kind of sciencey friends about all this stuff, they kind of have the view that it's all well and interesting, but it's not really very important. And I just wonder if I guess if you think that scientists themselves should have a better grasp of this philosophy of science.
Well, I think the big problem here, you may have noticed in the talk that I was, that in the way I spoke in the talk, I didn't use a lot of the philosophical language of relativism, constructivism, and all that kind of stuff, because in a sense, that's kind of what the scientists confront initially, right? And that's, in a sense, the science wars get conducted with that currency, right? So you're either a realist or a relativist, constructivist, or something like that. And for me, those are ideological tokens. They really mask what the real issues are. And there's a sense in which one of the things that's kind of unfortunate is we tend to talk about this stuff too abstractly, you see? And I think, what you should get your friends to look at is how are these people actually describing science in their cases? Because one of the things that will become very clear if they look enough of the sociological literature that's coming out now is that science, the story of science is the story of everything. In a sense, science is no longer clearly definable. It's no longer clearly identifiable from everything else that happens to be going on in the episode one's talking about. And I would think that somebody who sort of believes that science is kind of a vehicle for truth or rationality or progress or has a kind of distinctive angle on things would be very disturbed by that. Okay? Not because of relativism, realism, or any of the philosophical stuff, but just by the overall image of science that it's being presented, where science no longer has a kind of leadership role, no longer has a kind of focus, but is rather just in the mix. You see, because that is kind of the image that we're getting now. Okay? Yeah.
I was going to ask something that along those lines. You said a while back that Kuhn didn't really influence physics, but that his work influenced the fields that he did mention.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, the way in which, I'll tell you about sociology, because in the social sciences, he's been incredibly influential. And I think the reason why he was influential in all these non-physics fields reflects the fact that physics was regarded as the paradigm of science during this period, right? If we're thinking about the Cold War, physics was king, right? And so all these disciplines, in a sense, Kuhn kind of, he was read as giving a recipe of how you can make yourself look like the way physics did. The problem with the Popperians and the positivists, they too thought physics was king, but their standards were sort of impossibly high in a way, right? That no discipline could ever really match up to them. Whereas Kuhn actually gave a kind of more down-to-earth view of physics that made other fields think, oh, we could kind of do that too. I mean, that's kind of the way, this is not what Kuhn was intending, let me tell you. But it seems to me that was how he was read precisely in that way. He gave a kind of more earthly, kind of more normal sort of view about how science operates based on a physics model, which was the most prestigious model, and so that and all the other fields picked up on it. Now, in sociology, and this is true of social sciences generally, they basically messed around with some of his fundamental assumptions. That was another thing. They didn't, take Kuhn in the way Kuhn intended to be taken. So, for example, Kuhn believes that if you're a real science, there's only one paradigm at any given time. There's only one paradigm. There are not multiple paradigms. If you've got multiple paradigms, you don't have a science. You just have ideological dispute or something like that. Right? And in fact, the way Kuhn tells the story of the history of science, as it were in the beginning, right, there was massive warfare because you had all these different people with different metaphysical assumptions who could never agree upon any way of adjudicating the differences in their knowledge claims. There was no common method, there was no common theory, and it was only the people who could agree on the common methods and common theories who then became the scientists. And this is where something like the Royal Society became so important, because the Royal Society in its charter, and this is one of the conditions of getting its charter, right, basically said you had to leave politics and rhetoric and ethics and religion and all that kind of metaphysics, you had to leave all that at the door. You don't bring it in to the house of science. You see, and that for Kuhn is kind of the signature moment in the history of science, where you actually get a science. Now, the social sciences would not fit this definition because, of course, the metaphysics and the religion and the politics and all the rest of it is never left at the door. It's always pretty close to the surface, at least by the standards of physics. Okay, but the point is that assumption that Kuhn makes, that's very important for his model, got suspended by the social scientists who took him up. Okay, so that's basically how it happened. Another field did the same thing. I mean, because you know when it gets right down to it, Kuhn's, you know, how do you become a scientist? Well, you know, in a sense, the scientists have to be able to take control of the means of knowledge production. It's really, that's what it boils down to.
So you think Kuhn has this idea of what is science and what is it just as much as...
Oh, yes. Well, oh,
yeah.
For sure.
But he never comes out and says that's not science.
Exactly. What were you? What? Why?
I can see that Popper would say that because he can say, "Well, you're not adhering to the ideal of science, so you shouldn't have the authority of empirical."
Well, I mean, you know, it depends. How, you know, we can sort of answer this question at several levels, but I suppose the most obvious way of answering it is biographically. And basically, Kuhn was very disappointed about what happened to physics in World War II, where it basically just scaled up and became this mass. Because remember, World War I was the war that was chemistry determined, right? And physics was playing a sort of secondary role. But World War II was really the war where the destructiveness of the physical sciences really became very evident. And Kuhn was actually involved in that, as a lot of people of his generation, okay, people born in the 1920s. And these are the guys who, as it turns out, founded the fields of history and philosophy of science. People like Toulmin and John Zeman and Derek DeSola Price and Gerald Holton, Stephen Toulmin, all these people, Feyerabend too, all these people, physics-trained people, all born in the 1920s, all having gone through the World War II experience, all very turned off by it in terms of what happened to physics in that context. And afterwards, kind of what they all did was to try to recover through the history and philosophy of science kind of the ideals that led them to go into that subject. Because Kuhn, no differently from Popper, believed in this idea that physics was natural philosophy by more exact means. Right? And that seemed to have gotten lost in World War II and never recovered, right? It never recovered because after World War II, in a sense, the way science moved was to kind of stabilize and intensify that change, you see? And so I think there's this issue of keeping alive an ideal that had been lost historically. That's why it's really important to get a sense of where are these people in history when they're saying these things? And where are we now, 25, 30 years later, thinking about this? Because science has changed again, you see? And I think that's where it becomes really important, because in a sense the views are still with us, but their significance changes as the social and historical conditions change. You know, I mean, one of the things that's really, I'll give you an example of something that I find very striking. A lot of older scientists, maybe these are people who would not associate themselves with Kuhn or any kind of particular philosophy of science, they have had a hard time adjusting to the sort of changing climate in which science is being funded these days. Okay, in a sense, you know, these are the people who would say, look, if you want to study science, you really have to get a firm grounding and a discipline, and you shouldn't just go into these user-friendly, interdisciplinary things immediately, even though that's always more attractive to potential employers. Because employers are always imagining, you know, environments of R&D and so forth, where it's important for people from many different fields to be able to work together well. And if somebody's too specialized and too kind of entrenched in one way of thinking, they can't get on well with people in other fields, right? But of course, these older scientists are quite used to the idea, this kind of Kuhnian idea, of fixated on a paradigm, solving problems that are defined by the paradigm, and not having to relate to anything else outside of it. And those people have a very hard time understanding this kind of sea change that's taking place, okay? Because and I think that's the kind of thing you know that's going on now that one has to, you know, appreciate. Yes, sir.
You said earlier that sort of Kuhnian legacy to science studies was the science, people, scientists
Oh, yes. Well, this is why Kuhn was very critical of science studies, right? Yeah, yeah, but see, what Kuhn didn't do, and this is the missing, this is the thing in a way that has caused my interpretation to be very controversial, is I actually read into the fact that he never actually criticized the state of science today. See, one of the things that Kuhn, you know, because you would think from all of this picture I've been giving you that the next logical step for somebody like Kuhn would be to criticize the military-industrial complex, to criticize market conditions, to criticize all these ways in which science has been sort of put into captivity. But he never kept his mouth shut. And I criticize him for that, but I also think he was being strategic at the same time. And this has a lot to do with the influence his book had. And so there's a kind of issue here, right? Here's this guy, Kuhn. He's the most influential man about talking about science, right? What's he going to do now? If he actually criticizes the state of science, he's going to be seen as trashing science. And I think at the end of the day, Kuhn didn't want to trash science. Because there were enough of his followers who already tried to do that. Okay? And so there was a really difficult political issue here about what to do. Now, there is actually a book that I would recommend to you if you're interested in, as it were, you know, what if, you know, what would the Kuhnian view look like if it was actually used as a kind of critical tool to criticize the military-industrial complex in the 1970s and 60s. Right? There's this book called Scientific Knowledge and Its Social Problems. Came out in 1971. And the author is an expatriate American who's still alive, Jerome Rabbits. Somebody you should have him speak here. He has an office in the Barbican. He's still alive. This is the man that tried to take Kuhn in a radical direction, who basically said, look, if you've got Kuhn's view of science, and you live in the kind of world in which we live in the 1960s and 70s, then what follows, you've got to be critical of the state of science. You've got to say, science has been taken over by the military establishment. Science has been taken over by industry. Science is no longer this paradigm-driven, puzzle-solving activity. And he wrote this book. It's a brilliant book. It's still worth reading today. It's one of the first expressions of issues having to do with research ethics, intellectual property. This is back in 1971, in the height of the Vietnam War. Okay? It was published by Oxford University Press, too. It got a lot of play in its day. But it died. It died. And it never got taken up in science studies. This is an interesting thing. See, science studies is like the cockroaches. We adapt very well. And the point is, this was very much going against the grain. This was going against the grain. Okay, this book. And indeed, one of the things that I discovered when I went into the Kuhn archives at MIT, there's a 30-year correspondence between Kuhn and Rabbits. Rabbits really admired Kuhn. And Kuhn, had good feelings toward Rabbits until Kuhn got a copy of Rabbits' book. And so there's a little correspondence about this. And then about 5 years later, Rabbits applied, he wants to get back to the United States, basically. And so he applies for a professorship at the University of Pennsylvania. And he asks Kuhn, will you write me a letter of recommendation? And Kuhn says, sure. So in the Kuhn file, there is a letter from the chair of the department asking Kuhn, well, this guy Rabbits has applied for the post, and he looks good, and he says, you're one of his recommended, what do you think? Kuhn trashes him. Okay? Rabbits didn't know this until I told him. 30 years later, 25 years later, okay? And it's interesting to look at the letter, right? What does Kuhn say? Kuhn says, this guy Rabbits has turned into some kind of politician, some kind of, he's getting involved in these areas that have nothing to do with science or scholarship or anything like that. So I think, he just sort of left it all behind. Now, I thought this was really quite significant because it says a lot about Kuhn and the way he thought about, at least the way he thought about the kind of times in which he lived. Whoa. That was a phone, for the record. That was that wasn't an expression of dissatisfaction. But you see, Kuhn really thought that sharp lines had to be drawn between doing science and scholarship on the one hand and doing politics. And Rabbits had crossed the line because he used Kuhn's views for critical purposes. Okay? And, I'll tell you, the more I looked into this Kuhn stuff, the worse this guy looks. You know, either that or you just have to imagine Cold War America was about as repressive as Nazi Germany. I mean, given the way this guy refused to get involved in anything political. Okay? Even though his views do would seem to suggest that one ought to be critical of the way science is organized today. By the way, for the record, Popper, Lakatosh, Feyerabend, Toulmin, all these guys who were Kuhn's contemporaries, they all spoke out against the military-industrial complex in the 60s and 70s. They all did, even though not all of them were associated with the left. But they all spoke out against the way in which science was being used and abused during this period, but Kuhn never did. Okay? But that's the thing. That's the interesting... And see, Kuhn, though, nevertheless, is still this kind of great icon of science. And, you know, one has to wonder, what exactly are we valorizing here in this guy?
Steve,
yes.
I'm going to wrap it up with one last question, if I may.
Sure.
Which is, for science communicators, how should they take these ideas? I mean, you talked about science studies essentially having kind of given itself to mere description, of course.
Yeah.
But science communicators tend to have an ideological sense themselves, a moral sense about what science should be. How do you think a science communicator should take these views?
Well, I think, you know, you as communicators have to be clear in your mind what exactly you think you're defending when you're defending science. Because defending science isn't the same thing, you know, as defending the person paying for you, okay, necessarily. I mean, maybe this is an issue about who you work for, if you're going to be a science communicator, because I know a lot of science communicators essentially go into a kind of public relations for science, and I don't want to say there's anything intrinsically wrong with that, but you have to be, you know... But nevertheless, you should be very clear in your mind what you think you're doing, okay? Because just because somebody calls themselves a scientist and have a lab running and gets a lot of money doesn't necessarily mean that they're living up to the ideals of science that, let's say, made you first interested in science, okay? And I think you should be very clear about that in your mind. You know, who exactly you work for, you know, and what exactly, you know, you're doing with respect to them, okay? Now, of course, if you're happy to be a mouthpiece, to be perfectly honest, there are more straightforward ways of doing it than going into science communication. But if you're in it for some kind of idealistic reason, you have to realize that a lot of people who are involved in the business of science today are involved in science as a business, and nothing more than that. And people in science studies are quite happy to accept that, okay? Because remember, this is part of the blurring of science and technology and industry and society and life and all the rest of it. It's part of that blurring process, where in a sense, everything is everything else. And when everything's everything else, of course, there are no hard moral decisions or any hard choices to be made. Okay? And so I think that would be kind of the main lesson in a way. And that, you know, it's not by accident that people like Popper and the Positivists and Kuhn are people who went through two world wars, and certainly the Popper and the Positivists did, right? And in each of those wars, science was seriously compromised. I mean, we didn't talk about the end of World War I, because that's when the Positivists and Popper got their formative years. But part of the idea of separating out science from technology is something that really started to happen a lot more in the 1920s than it ever had done previously, precisely as a way of saving science from the bad consequences of being involved with the military effort, especially in Germany, in World War I. Okay? And so that was what all this philosophy has always been about, in a way, is to sort of preserve the idea when it gets kind of contaminated or corrupted, not because they have some kind of airy-fairy notion, but because it actually already had happened. The contamination and corruption already took place, and they're trying to salvage something from it. Okay? And I think that, you know, as science communicators, when you think about what is the message you're trying to get across about science, that those kinds of lessons from history should be in the forefront of your mind.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Steve. I'd like to say thank you for your characteristic generosity of your ideas, and I hope you can think a bit more about these as time goes by, and I hope to see you again next year.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you.